Next up is a man who has not been afraid to speak truth to power. Even when we were hearing of people, you know, whose lives were being threatened, especially during the Gupta Gate. And I quite enjoyed listening to him and Reedy Tlhabi on the Midday Report. And I'm talking about, in his bio, he puts, just political journalist. Ladies and gentlemen, he's an award-winning political journalist, radio host, TV presenter, and writer. He has been reporting on our politics from 2005 and has been on the front line of all the major political events of the last 15 years. He is currently the host of SAFM Sunrise, the flagship breakfast show on SAFM, and presents three nights a week on The Full View, the evening program on the SABC News Channel 404. Stephen is also a writer at the Daily Maverick website, where he reports on and analyzes our politics. He spent 15 years at Radio 702 before moving to the SABC in 2018. He is in daily contact with the country's decision makers and has an intimate knowledge of how South Africa works and how decisions are made. He also speaks to investors and gives presentations on a regular basis, as he is doing so graciously today. Ladies and gentlemen, a very roaring round of applause for Stephen Grotius.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Good morning. The problem with doing a presentation after Zapiro is you know that your slides aren't going to match. There's just no way. The only slides that come close are two of his own cartoons that he's allowed me to use. And I know, I'm just going to move this along a little bit if I can. I know that when it comes to our politics, there are very many difficult questions that we all want to ask. And I suppose, considering my audience, I should start with some numbers. And the only question I know that you want to ask is what's going to happen in next year's elections. After that, it's going to be, is Julius Malema going to be president? And after that, why is it that we're supporting Russia and not Ukraine? We'll get to all of that, but let me start with the most important thing, which is what's going to happen in next year's elections. Now, some of the things are obvious as to what will happen, and some of the things are not. There's probably one or two definite certainties. The first, I think we can say with a lot of confidence, is that the ANC will be the biggest party after the elections next year. Julius Malema may think that the EFF is going to get him into the union buildings next year. You can go and tell him that it won't. While you're there, you can break the news to John Steenhuisen or Helen Ziller, take your pick, if you like. If the ANC gets above 50%, it's obvious they stay in power, things kind of continue as they are. That's the easy sort of scenario. At 48%, if the ANC gets 48%, what happens then? Well, they'll do what they've done in the past. They'll go and find a small political party, and they will bully the hell out of them. And that small political party will very happily take a seat in cabinet, maybe two seats in cabinet, maybe even just a deputy minister's position, and that will be that. This has happened before many times, by the way. We had a government of national unity with F.W. de Klerk in the cabinet of Nelson Mandela. We had the Freedom Front Plus as a deputy minister of agriculture under former president Jacob Zuma. We had ZAPO in cabinet as well at one point. So this has happened before. Nothing really changes. The fun and games starts when the ANC gets to 45%. That's when it starts to get really interesting. So what's the best option? Well, what you really would do is you'll get two or three smaller parties and bully them. Much easier. You don't then have to deal with anyone. The real problem starts at 42. If the ANC gets below 42, this is when things start to get really interesting. Now, there are a couple of things you could do. The obvious question is, do you do a coalition with the EFF, or do you do a coalition with the DA? Both of these are very difficult choices for the ANC. And I know that there's, I shouldn't do this, but there's News 24 piece after News 24 piece saying that it's going to be Julius. I have a slightly different view, and for various reasons. But the fact is that that's where things start to get really interesting. I would like to say that it is not necessarily the obvious answer for the ANC to actually go into a coalition with one bigger party. Let me sort of explain why. So what happens? These are coalitions that we've had. That's, you don't know who that is. That's Kabelo Gwamanda. He's the mayor of Joburg. Really, he is from El Jamar. They have three seats in Joburg. They've already been through one mayor already. He's the second. They've got one more to go. And then that's all the councillors that El Jamar has in Joburg that can be appointed. Now, here, a couple of fascinating things. He was elected by ANC and EFF councillors. Why? Because they cannot vote for each other as mayor. The ANC refuses to vote for an EFF candidate to be mayor of Joburg, Ekurhuleni, or Nelson Mandela Bay, or Mogale City in Gauteng. And so the deal they have is they elect a minority. The ANC currently has a standing political policy, a principle, that they will not elect minority parties as mayor. But that's what they've done. Now, how does this happen? Well, it's the best indication there is of the fractures in the ANC. You've got the Gauteng ANC that wants to do one thing, and you've got the national ANC that wants to do something else. And it's not even that simple, I'm afraid, because in Ekurhuleni, where you have a minority leader from the ATM, the Ekurhuleni leader of the ANC doesn't want to be in a coalition with the EFF, but has been told to by the provincial leadership, whereas the national leadership of the ANC doesn't want them to be in a coalition with the EFF either. I know, the numbers are much easier, right? So much simpler. So here's the problem. The EFF and the ANC, in their coalitions and their working agreements in Joburg and Ekurhuleni, are fighting all the time. They had a big fight in Ekurhuleni about, I'm not making this up, rubbish trucks. The EFF claimed, with no evidence, that the ANC had stolen rubbish trucks. The ANC, which by this stage had no trucks to give, I thought it was on the line. But what the ANC then said is, but we wrote off those trucks. And the EFF said, how do you know? And they said, because EFF, you voted to write them off in council. So that's just the kind of level of politics that we're at. Now, this gets us to my greater point. What strategic options are there for the ANC after the election, if it is, and I think our prediction will hold, if they get above 40%? What is the best strategic option? The best strategic option is not to go into a coalition with one party, because that one party will then be able to demand certain things or pull out and cost them national power. So in other words, if, as an example, the DA were the party that the ANC went into, and then there was a BRICS summit and Vladimir Putin was going to come as the Russian president, John Steenhuisen would say to Ramaphosa, you can't have Putin, we will leave the government if you do. Now, that's just bad for the ANC. It's bad for them to be in party with the EFF on a point of principle either. In my view, there are two things the ANC is going to want to do out of this election. It's going to want to retain power. It's going to want to stay to be the dominant party. And it's going to want to have as much power as possible in that context. In other words, it wants to not be beholden to any one person, especially the EFF, because you're only then beholden to Julius Malema. That's how they make decisions. Anyone heard of the EFF going against a decision by Julius Malema? Me neither. So, what happens then? The best option, actually, if you get to 42%, is to get together a much bigger coalition of smaller parties. 5, 6, 7 of them. You don't get to 50% or 50.1 or 51%. You get to 55%. Because then no one party can actually remove you from power. Much better strategic choice. Now, how do you do that? Well, hopefully for the ANC, but not for voters, the president can make cabinets as big as he wants. Literally, you could have a cabinet of 200 people if you wanted. Each cabinet position under the presidential handbook, the presidential handbook is not by law of parliament, it's what the president says that is in the presidential handbook. This is what ministers get. Each minister currently gets to appoint 12 people to a job. Think about that. That's your family and your friend's family taken care of, okay? 12, no questions asked, by the way, 12 people. Now, you now need 5 people, 6 parties. What do you think is going to happen? You give them 6 or 7 positions in cabinet, each get one. They each get to employ 12 people. They each get, by the way, the biggest perk of being in cabinet, which is a generator. And as a result of that, you then still outvote them in cabinet. So you carry on as before. No threat. They can't leave. They're not going to leave. Because if they leave, it doesn't achieve anything. Much better strategic choice for the ANC. There are a couple of caveats to this, which are fascinating. Which is what the ANC could also do, is do a grand coalition with a lot of small parties, a high number of small parties, and the Democratic Alliance. Because then it wouldn't be a coalition with the DA. A coalition with the DA for the ANC is very difficult. But a coalition as part of a grand coalition with a lot of smaller parties and the Democratic Alliance, but no EFF, might work. That might be It's quite a middle-class room, I think. Might be what many people in the middle classes would suggest is probably the best outcome for the country. Now, I must just mention this word complexity in our politics, because within all of these negotiations, we've got 9 provinces that are voting next year as well. And in 3 of them, and possibly 5, we'll have coalition governments too. Okay? So in Gauteng, almost certainly. In the Free State, almost certainly. How the ANC has managed to get so close to losing the Free State is amazing to me, but well done, Ace Magashule. You get a gold star, you've done it. Now, KwaZulu-Natal, also, they might lose KwaZulu-Natal. So what happens then? Well, what you can also do is you can go to a smaller party and say, we'll make you Premier of KwaZulu-Natal and you support us in national government. We don't even need to give you a cabinet position, but you get to be Premier of KwaZulu-Natal. The point I'm making is how complex the situation can actually be. It could be a couple of months before we get a very clear picture of what actually is going to emerge out of these elections. I must just point out the obvious. I realize we're in Cape Town and I haven't seen a pothole since I got here. But I live in Joburg, and it's a disaster. I live in a very nice area. I go for a week or so without electricity, without water, all of these things. I have my own solar. It's the way of things. And the point is that that is also a result of coalition government. It's a result of other things too, a long and very difficult history, also the pandemic, but it is also a result of coalition politics. I don't think the country necessarily goes like Joburg. I don't think a national coalition would be anything as difficult as the local coalitions for quite important reasons. One is they're better politicians in national government, by which I mean they're professional politicians, not Kebelo Gwamanda, who, by the way, Kebelo Gwamanda contradicts his own party's stated view on one of their most important policy planks. El Jamar is a homophobic party. He is not, and has said so publicly. Which is amazing. He's the most public person that belongs to that political party, and he disagrees with one of their main policies. Isn't that fascinating? He's not even of the faith that El Jamar represents. He said to me that he believes he's an Africanist, and he says they accommodate me. But he's their most public figure. It's amazing what's going on. The bigger point to make is that, for me, if the ANC has a proper National Executive Committee meeting on the question, do we do a deal with the EFF or not? That meeting goes on for weeks. The party is hugely divided on the question. Why is it divided? It's divided because it's actually the party of the middle. And this is a choice between a side, the EFF on the one side and the DA on the other. And that's why the ANC is so divided in simple terms. I'm going to talk a little bit about much deeper politics. Anyone know at least 2 of those people? One of them, okay. One guy in 2019 was holding a big trophy up in the sky, Sia Khaleesi, and his wife Rachel Khaleesi. She put this on Instagram. These are members of his family, okay, at an initiation hut in the Eastern Cape. It's an amazing picture in many ways because it tells us how South Africa is changing, and it also reveals the elements of the identity of the Khaleesi family. You have a person who's a Springbok rugby captain, born in incredibly poor circumstances in Zwide, went to pretty much a white, almost private school, got into rugby. So what are the elements of his identity? You have his wife, Rachel Khaleesi, white woman, white parents, black children. What does that make her? She's actually one of the children is Sia Khaleesi's brother, which they've adopted. So it's a blended family in many ways as well. The point of this is about the elements of political identity. Let me explain what I mean. If you were in a British pub in London in 2019 when we won the Rugby World Cup, and you were a South African in that pub, surrounded by English people. I can't imagine anything worse, but there you are. You're a South African in an English pub, and there's one other South African there. It doesn't matter which part of South Africa you're from. It doesn't matter what language you speak and what the other person speaks. You're the best friends that you've ever met for that night, especially when we won, right? So it doesn't matter that one of you speaks Afrikaans and one of you speaks Xhosa. It doesn't matter that one of you benefited and still benefits from apartheid and one of you was oppressed. It doesn't matter. You are South African. That's the only element of your identity that matters. You win the World Cup, you have a great night, you swap phone numbers, etc. You get to Heathrow, and as you queue up, you see other South Africans queuing up with you, and you're suddenly not best of friends anymore. Because your other South African elements of identity suddenly start to come into play because you see other people who are South African but are more like you, whether they're black, white, Xhosa, Zulu, whatever it is. So suddenly the main element of your identity in the pub was that you were South African. When you see other South Africans, your other elements of identity come to the fore. Let me use another example. If you are the only actuary in a convention of accountants, the fact that you are an actuary matters, especially if someone tells a, you know, joke about actuaries. But it doesn't matter if you're out in a restaurant with a group of accountants at all. But if you're at an accounting convention, it suddenly does matter. And that's because of the element of identity. If you are the only woman in a room and a man tells a sexist joke, you're going to feel that identity very keenly. You're going to feel it very badly. The same goes for race in all sorts of different ways. Now, identities change. There are plenty of perhaps older people in South Africa who would never believe that they would have friends who would be gay. Suddenly, they have a grandchild who identifies as gay or a grandchild who identifies as transgender. And suddenly that elderly, maybe white person, finds themselves agreeing with Julius Malema that Uganda's homophobic bill is wrong. See how identities can change. You feel different things at different times. Now, this is what politicians do, is they try and make you feel different things at times so that you vote their way. Let me use another example. If you listen to President Cyril Ramaphosa when he talks, say, at the funeral of Winnie Madikizela Mandela, and he says, "We are a nation in pain, fearful of our future," you feel South African. It doesn't matter who you are. If you're South African, you feel South African. When you hear Julius Malema speak, you feel black or you feel white, because he's made that choice. That's a deliberate choice. Now, don't think bad of Malema for this too much, because it's what politicians do all the time, everywhere. And it's why in the United States, abortion's become a key issue, because politicians look for wedge issues to try and get people to support them and not anyone else. And the ultimate expression of the wedge issue in the US is abortion. Abortion is not something we should fight about. Abortion is something that you would sit down and work out a very careful thing to try and help as many people and to make abortions as rare as you can. But you would allow it. In the United States, because of wedge issues, you now have situations where some states are thinking of pregnancy testing women who are leaving the state in case they're going to another state to have an abortion. I mean, people actually publicly say this. Are they insane? But they do that as a wedge issue to try and get votes. And this is what politicians do. You see this, of course, in Russia and Ukraine. Let me explain why. There's some South Africans, I'm one of them, you grew up reading Wilbur Smith, you grew up reading Tom Clancy, you grew up watching, I don't know, The A-Team or something. And Russia was bad, America was good. That's the cultural things that we saw. Every James Bond movie you've ever seen. If you were black growing up in South Africa, well, Moscow was helping you. Russia was helping you. The Soviet Union was someone that helped you. They were fighting the West. Ronald Reagan would not impose sanctions against South Africa, so he was helping the oppressor. So these different elements of our identity suddenly start to come into play. And in my view, to try and understand the ANC support for Russia, or presumed support for Russia, it's really about the history of the United States in South Africa. And in fact, Antony Blinken, the US Secretary of State, said this publicly in a very particular place. He was talking to The Atlantic, and he said that we as America are paying the price for a mistake we made during apartheid in South Africa. And he went on to say, when I say mistake, we're being polite. But what he means is that America was immoral in the 1980s towards black South Africans. The one American politician, by the way, who wasn't, was a very young senator from Delaware who said that people say we mustn't take sides in South Africa. We must take sides in South Africa. We must take the sides of oppressed black people in South Africa. His name was Joe Biden. I suppose the next question, of course, is, you know, and Jonathan Zapiro touched on this. Has President Ramaphosa failed? It's true that life has got worse since Ramaphosa became president. Anyone dispute that, even in Cape Town? I think life has probably got worse since Ramaphosa became president. It's also true, by the way, of President Biden in the States. It's also true of President Xi in China. And the point is the pandemic and the way the world has gone. There's certain things, you put high food prices into the mix, life is going to get difficult almost no matter where you are, and that's pretty much what's happened. However, he seems to have almost no interest in improving things. There are very few moments where you see him actually being interested in leadership, and this is the problem. In my view, his biggest mistake has been to put the interests of the ANC above the interests of the country. However, and it can get quite tricky, if you were to replace Ramaphosa tomorrow with almost anyone, I can't see what that person would do differently. And this is the problem. The problem is the country. The country is hard to govern. He also has what he still has what I call his A-bomb, his last sort of play, which is that his approval rating would go up dramatically if there were certain things he did, if he removed the state capture people from his cabinet, for example. So one of the reasons he has a low approval rating is because of things he hasn't yet done, which means he could one day still do them. I don't know if he will, but he could still do them. The other thing, and this is important, where Ramaphosa has been very strong, is he's appointed the right people, in my view, to head the National Prosecuting Authority and SARS. I mean, SARS is getting so much more money in than it did. It's so much better than it was. Look, it's coming off a low base. Also, at the NPA, he's appointed good people to institutions, and institutions will last longer than him. And that's really important. It's absolutely vital. It's the only slide I have that's as good as any of Zapiro's. If you were to look at the situation around the ANC right now, you would think the obvious thing that the ANC would do would be absolutely focused on getting above 50%. You would govern better, you would have no scandals, there would be unity, there would be everybody marching to the same beat, there would be a focus on load shedding, you would never have an energy minister saying one thing and an electricity minister saying something else. And that's not what's happening. And why isn't it happening? Well, it's not happening for a couple of reasons. The one is that people, when they think they're about to lose power, react in different ways. In my view, some people in the ANC are thinking, let's focus on keeping saying above 50%. And some people are thinking, let me take what I can take now while we're still in power. And that explains some of the differences. You also have some of the people elected into leadership. I know you're recording this, and I hope he sees it. Fikile Mbalula, who's the Secretary General of the ANC, has lied in public many times, including about me, but he has lied in public many times. You cannot have a functioning ANC with a Secretary General that does not tell the truth. Let me explain why I say that. It's not just a political statement. I'm making a structural statement, which is that the office of the Secretary General in the ANC has to deal with disputes all the time between individuals in the ANC, branches, regions, provinces, and leagues. If you have someone who does not tell the complete truth, they will get found out and their word will be ignored, and the ANC will not survive that. And for me, one of the biggest threats to the ANC actually is Fikile Mbalula and his conduct in the past, when he has lied so often. I mean, he tweeted that he had just landed in Ukraine. Completely a lie. He was either high or drunk at the time, and or he didn't tweet it himself and he'd given his device to someone else. And he has a duty to tell us which it was. It can only be those three things. Also, it's not just Fikile Mbalula. Nomvula Mokonyane is the Deputy Secretary General of the ANC. She's the first Deputy Secretary General. When she left the Water Affairs Department, the minister who took over from her, an ANC person, Kugile Nkwinti, said, she has left the department in a mess. His words, not mine. This is not journalistic hyperbole. This is an ANC minister saying, it's a mess. Nomvula Mokonyane, responsible for that. Now she's Fikile Mbalula's deputy. Both of them, by the way, like a good shouting match, so it's going to be fun and games in the office of the Secretary General in the ANC. The other thing is, and this is really important, there was a time when, as a journalist, you would be very careful how you approached an ANC person. I'm talking 10, 15 years ago, because the public was with the ANC. If you were to take on Manta Chabalala Mzimang or then-President Mbeki on HIV/AIDS, you had to be very careful how you did that. There's some famous interviews from that time. That has changed completely. And it's changed completely for a couple of reasons. One is democracy has just deepened. And democracy isn't just one vote once in 1994. It deepens over time. And so that means that ANC people now, Panyaza Lesufi will do every single media interview he can because he knows that he needs to be speaking to voters as much as possible, otherwise someone else will. That's what he's doing. And that means, that shows you the democratization process has deepened. And the ANC just doesn't have the same power that it did before. You can, you know, nowadays, if an ANC person attacks a presenter on talk radio, the audience, even if they don't like the presenter, are with the presenter because they feel the presenter represents them. That wasn't the case 20 years ago. Life has really changed. And you see it all the time because the deference to the ANC is gone. And what people say, it's just gone. The Democratic Alliance, of course, has its own problems. I don't have a picture of him in a spacesuit, unfortunately, but if that picture exists, it will one day emerge. The DA has what I would call a heart versus a head problem. If you look at Auditor General reports, half of the municipalities that got clean audits were in the Western Cape. Okay? Now, why is that? I don't know. Let me think. That's because they're run by the DA. There's a reason why Cape Town is, or certainly the middle-class bits of Cape Town, are run much better than those parts of other cities. It's because it is run better. And I think we can accept the Auditor General's view on that. So you would say, if you're voting with your head, don't you just vote for the better governance person? It's not nearly that simple. Because the DA, almost deliberately it seems, turns against the hearts of most voters in this country. Let me give you an example. Over the weekend, Julius Malema stood up and sang Dibulu Ibulu, kill the Boer, at the FNB stadium. Now, he was doing nothing illegal at all when he did that. The last ruling on the matter is that he is allowed to sing it. Whether he should sing is a very different thing. John Steenhuisen rushes out a statement they're going to the United Nations Human Rights Committee. Oh, please. Why? What is he going to achieve there? Now, different people are receiving different messages from this. What many black people are receiving, in my view, I can't speak for them, of course, is that they are seeing a person standing up and saying, you are not allowed to sing a liberation song that is actually about the apartheid system, which still defines my life. In the United States, there used to be a phrase, I'm going to stick it to the man. The man is the system. Ibunu is the system, which still defines, our society is still defined by racialized inequality, still defines the lives of most people. So that's what the DA is saying. The DA is saying, we support restrictions on what you can say when you are protesting against the lived experience of apartheid. Now, how many people are going to vote for the DA if that's how you feel? No one. And that's the problem that the party has, is that it is sending different things to different people and deliberately almost antagonizing a broad majority of voters in South Africa. There are a couple of other things to the DA which I must just mention. The one is it is still true that the DA is the most diverse party in the country. Now, that also means that the tensions in our society around race and class are also expressed within the DA to a greater extent than other parties. You don't have an argument about affirmative action in the Freedom Front Plus, okay? They're all against it. In the DA, it's not quite like that because you have younger, sometimes black members who are saying, we support affirmative action, or we support employment equity, or we support black economic empowerment. And you have older, often white members of the DA who disagree with that. And so that's the tension in the party. And that's what puts them in such a difficult position. That's why they find it really quite difficult to actually be coherent. And they've clearly made a decision since Musi Maimane resigned. They've clearly made a decision to go for one group of people, and that's what they're doing. Well, that's fine. You're never going to be president like that. Then we have the EFF. And we've seen, in some ways, well, you know, yes, it's easy to fill a stadium, 95,000 people. It's actually quite difficult to fill a stadium of 95,000 people. Julius Malema did that over the weekend. That doesn't translate into votes, by the way. We've seen full stadiums before. We've seen political parties having big numbers of members before. The biggest the ANC's ever been was about, depending on whose figure you choose, then-President Zuma's or Ace Magashule's, about 1.2 to 1.6 million in 2015, just before they lost all of the big metros in Gauteng. So don't be confused between membership and votes. The DA has never told us how many members they have. I'm sort of worried sometimes that maybe the membership of the DA is kind of the size of this room. It's obviously not. I've been to their conferences. It's much bigger than that. My point is that a small party, if it wins votes, has power. A big party with millions of members, if it doesn't have votes, doesn't have power. And that's the point. There are, to me, and I worry that this may be wishful thinking in some ways, but there are some signs of desperation in Malema. trying to dominate the national discussion all the time. I don't see signs of momentum. Let's explain why I say that. You would think, if you look at the conditions on the ground, depending again on which number you look at, between 60 and 70% of young people in this country are unemployed. The vast majority of them are black. They have no hope. The system has betrayed them almost from birth, really, particularly the education system. You would think that Julius Malema is going to get a lot more votes in that case, and yet he has not. Now, how? Why not? Surely. I mean, how can you fail in that situation? There are lots of reasons. Young people don't vote, and that's a universal, by the way. In most countries, young people don't vote very much. But I think there's some signs of desperation. There's also the most intense contradictions. First, he was opposed to Busasiem Kubani, then he supported her, then he supported her, then he was opposed to her, now he supports her again. He felt that Judge John Klopper was a rotten potato, and now he says that he should be Chief Justice. I mean, how? And then you have, on some things which are just bizarre, 2 months ago, Julius Malema outside the Ugandan High Commission protesting against their homophobic law, and then inviting a homophobe to come and address their lecture. Not just allowing him, inviting him. And that's astonishing. But the point is that voters see the contradictions. They know the contradictions. So then I think that costs Malema votes. Because what do you stand for? What are you standing for? What really matters? If we can't trust you on homophobia or on Busasiem Kubani, how can we trust you on land? You see the point? So the contradictions and the flip-flops seem to matter. There are a few things. I am really near the end, really. I know some people think so are we, but anyway. Eskom and water, are they only going to get worse? So far, winter hasn't been as bad as we thought it would be. We haven't had stage 8 come close, but it's actually been better than we thought it would be. And a few things are happening. What is true is that there is a huge amount of attention and a huge amount of investment and a huge amount of building and generation capacity. Independent power producers are coming online. I'm sure if you read Business Day, you won't go through an edition without actually reading a story about the national grid and whether it's going to have space to take all of this power, and that's the next problem. But that's a much better problem to have than not having the power in the first place. The grid is what binds this country together, by the way. If you do not have everybody on the same grid, you cannot use rich people to subsidize poor people, and we will not survive as a country if we do not have rich people subsidizing poor people. It is an existential threat to South Africa. We must have it. Now, richer people and businesses are all trying to get off the grid as quickly as they can. I can't blame them for that. I'm trying to do it myself. But we all need to be part of the same electricity system. Otherwise, we are going to literally have a country of darkness and gulfing estates with electricity. And we cannot, we will not survive that experience. So that, the grid, fixing the grid, never mind the actual getting the power in, fixing the grid is vitally important. We all need to be part of the same thing. There's a lot of intellectual capacity going into this, and I think they will fix it. Now, as an optimist, someone told me a few moments ago that I was way too optimistic. I think that's probably true. But, you know, we need a bit of irrationality sometimes. Maybe load shedding comes to an end by the end of this year. I think by the end of next year is much more realistic. But we are seeing so much power being added to the grid and so many different solutions in different places. Now, you could easily say to me, but Stephen, government built Kusile and Medupi and those were disasters and that was to stop load shedding. What's the difference between then and now? And it's an entirely legitimate question. The difference is then government was doing it. Eskom was doing it. Thanks for nothing, Matsela Koko. You were doing it. What we have now is the private sector doing it, and crucially, competition. Once you allow the private sector to start doing it, you can't stop them. It's the horrible thing about capitalists, is once they get going, you can't stop them. And that's what's happening now, and that's why we have a lot more reason to be optimistic. Because basically, government has relaxed its control, and other people are doing it. And those people actually get fired. There's actually consequence management if it doesn't work. And that's why I believe that it actually will work, and I think that's quite important. In a lot of places, water is going to be the next burning issue. You're absolutely going to see this because of the water infrastructure. It's not so much, is there enough water in the Vaal Dam, or what is happening there. It's about getting the water to your house or to your business, and that's going to be the problem. You're going to see that as the next focal point. I'm sure you've seen this quote. The old is still dying and the new cannot be born. And in the meantime, a lot of morbid symptoms appear. And the morbid symptoms that we see are all sorts of problems that we have in our society at the moment. I'm going to take questions in just a moment. But the morbid symptoms are Paul Mashatile's VIP protection unit, Paul Mashatile himself and the claims against him, Cyril Ramaphosa and Pala Pala, and by the way, on his own version of facts, it just cannot be true. There's something so strange happening there. But the bigger question is, what is the new? What is the new? I think there are certain predictions we can make about the new for South Africa. The one is a bigger role for the private sector. Whether you like it or not, there is a process of privatization by emergency. We've seen it in electricity. We're seeing it in Transnet right now. There's a tender out right now with almost no political argument. I mean, 10 years ago, we would have been, you know, this would have been the defining line in the ANC. But right now, there's a tender out for Transnet for the private sector to run the railway line from Durban to Johannesburg, to the main port. And it's unbelievable. They've also opened Pier 2, which is the busiest part of the Durban harbor, so the busiest part of the busiest harbor in the country, also to a private company, a Filipino-based company. It's also interesting. So we have this privatization through stealth, and it's happening in lots of different ways. SAA is going to be 51% owned by a private company. If you told me that 10 years ago, I wouldn't have believed you. Now, that does mean that some things will work. It means that some things will work for everybody, and some things will work only for the rich. Think Postnet versus the post office. When did you last go into a post office? And that's the difference. That's going to be one of the next dividing lines in our society. There are a few other things that are happening at the same time, which is that issues around identity, elements of identity, will also change. Now, this can go in different ways. There'll be some politicians like Malema who will try and keep our, and the Freedom Front Plus, and John Steenhuisen, who will try and keep our politics about race in different ways. And they'll probably have some success in doing that. There will be others, Herman Mashaba is one, who will try and get support from broad parts of society. The ANC intrinsically has a policy of non-racialism. They will try and stay the middle of the country. However, the issues and conversations around race will really only change if racialized inequality changes. As long as to be born white is to die rich and to be born black is to die poor, the conversations around race won't change. They will always be with us. The land question will also always be with us. And that's the basis of these conversations that we have around identity will only change if the economy changes in the broader term. The language that we use will change. But that fundamental issue will still stay with us in many, many ways. We're also, because of our status in the world, relatively small country, very open economy, and that's a crucial thing. We are also likely to really be the focal point of contention between the Western world, with all of its shiny new things, and the Russian world, with all of its shiny things. And what that means is that we're going to see a lot of contestation here, and the key country isn't Russia or the United States, but is China. And that we're going to see all sorts of times when South Africa is caught up in these big international things, like we've seen over BRICS, like we've seen over Putin, through no fault of our own. There is a thesis, not by me, but by someone else, he actually wrote a book about it, said that the future of the world will be determined by what happens in the United States and South Africa. Quite a thing. And their thesis is because these are the two countries where big groups of different people live and vote together. And if they can get on with each other, if that works, the world will work. I thought it was very interesting. And a very interesting thesis. So South Africa matters. The future of South Africa matters. And we are going to be in the middle of all of these fights through no fault of our own, just because we are. Right. I'm happy to take some questions. Thank you very much indeed for listening. Yes, sir. That was going to happen. Yeah.
Do you think there's a world where the ANC gets to 50% and then
I don't see it. I think that one of the problems that, you know, when you're going into election like next year's election, where coalitions are a possibility, you have to signal certain things. So you have to try and say to voters, if you don't vote for us, this will happen, which is really the DA's campaign. If you don't vote for us, the EFF, ANC doomsday coalition. Come on, John. But what that means is that you can't then, there's sort of limits on how far you can turn around. if you see what I mean. And then it gets quite difficult to actually now work with the person that you've created as a sort of bogeyman. You know, you've created as this monster hiding in the cupboard. So it gets quite difficult for you to do that. So I think there are limits. I don't think that the DA and the EFF will work together again. Yes, sir. So, I mean, there are a lot of things that are possible, and that would be one of them. I would have to say, though, that the ANC, so Ramaphosa is still the most known and still has a higher approval rating than Paul Mashatile. This doesn't directly answer your question, but if the ANC were to go into an election with Mashatile, I think it does worse than it goes into one with Ramaphosa for a few reasons. But the main one is that most people don't know Mashatile very well. He's a Gauteng politician. Yes, he was in cabinet for a while, but he's a Gauteng politician. He hasn't got a natural national constituency. We've never actually seen anyone in the ANC go from having a provincial constituency and then being able to make that a national constituency. All the presidents we've had were national leaders first. Mandela, Zuma, Ramaphosa, Mudlante too. Whereas the people who've tried to go from the province to national leadership have all failed in the longer run. So think William Kize, think David Mabuza, think Ace Magashule. And so that's one of the problems Mashatile has. I think that if the ANC goes into 50%, and then there's a discussion about whether Ramaphosa should resign or not, I don't know if the ANC survives that meeting. I think that would be the first thing. And the second thing is that, as I understand the ANC's constitution, Mashatile can't just be made leader. There would have to be a conference. You'd have to actually be elected. And that's one of the problems. So, I mean, look, all of those, if there's sufficient political will, you know, if 90% of the NEC thinks Mashatile should take over, you can get around all of those things. Also, by the way, if the ANC goes into an election with the EFF, get into a coalition with the EFF, the ANC probably wouldn't survive the election after that. And I think they would be very aware of that. They're very good strategists in the ANC. Yes, sir.
Hi, Stephen Hutus. Thanks for a brilliant presentation. But what are your thoughts on this school of thought to say, look, when the new dispensation came into power, right?
You mean 94?
Yes, 94.
Rather than Cyril.
Right. So the guys came from the bush, from being underground, to run the government, and the white race exited government to make space for these players to be economically active. So now, surely we should have anticipated a time of a similar time like is this one. And that was a necessary sacrifice to be done because you couldn't have soldiers coming in into the system without them having means of looking after their family. So I think what I'm trying to get your view on, wasn't it a bit too optimistic of us not to anticipate a challenging time such as this one? Because essentially, you were bringing people who didn't know how to govern to run a very sophisticated government. And similarly, obviously, you have the guys who were exiting government, highly sophisticated in terms of running things, but also they were also going to be committed in protecting their very small space because they had given away space. Yeah. So this space that they have now, they're really not going to let it go. That is obviously the white race. So I think maybe we were a bit too optimistic not to anticipate a very challenging period like this one. What's your view on this one?
You're suggesting we should have read a bit more Frantz Fanon in 94 rather than now. Let me put your question in different words and tell me if I get it right. What you may be suggesting is, were there structural reasons that we were always going to be here, no matter what? Yes and no. I think there's some merit to put the question in that way, because what you're saying is that when you transfer power to people who've never had political power before, there are always going to be some difficulties, and that's sort of true. However, I think that underestimates certain other things. Let me just explain what I mean. The first is that I think if you look at South Africa and try and forget apartheid for a moment, which is silly because it defines South Africa still, but let me just explain what I mean. And you look at the really diverse groups of people that we have. I mean, depending on which figure you want to use, you're looking at people who speak 35 different languages. And along with speaking different languages comes all sorts of cultural assumptions, ways of doing things, sometimes slightly different views on how you do business and what's right and what's wrong and what legal is. You put on top of that an oppressive system, which means that the rule of law is not legitimate because the rule of law was used to oppress people. And then you start to look at, you're going to have a problem governing that country. Okay. Do you see what I mean? So I think that governing South Africa is always going to be difficult. What the ANC had, which no other political formation has done in the history of the Republic of South Africa going back, or the Union of South Africa going back to 1910, is it was the only organization that unified people from across the country. It's the only one who's ever done it. We've had, I think, four or five local elections in this country. The ANC is the only party that's been able to have candidates in all wards in the country. The DA's done it just once. So what you're suggesting then is that you have structural reasons that make governance hard. And I think that's true. However, there's certain things which did never had to happen. At every point on HIV/AIDS, Mbeki made decisions and was wrong. Could have gone the other way on those decisions. Every time that Zuma decided to do something that helped the Guptas, he could have gone the other way, but he didn't. That was a personal choice. So I think we do need to, we must never remove the agency that our leaders have. We can't say, well, you don't have agency because this happened in the past, because not all leaders are the same, and they could have made different choices. Does that go any way at all to answering your question? It's a very complex question. I mean, it's set up for a debate for hours, but I'll be very careful of just saying yes to you. I don't think that would be correct. I think we can't remove the agency of leaders. Oh, jeez. Don't have time, yes. To the IFP. So, I mean, voters in KwaZulu-Natal are the most interesting voters we have in the country because they're the group of voters who have changed their political choices more than anyone else. White people have almost all voted for the ANC, white people have voted almost always for the DA almost all the time. Voters in KwaZulu-Natal first voted for the IFP in 94, then again in 99, and then slowly moved to the ANC and then are moving back to the IFP. And there's a strong possibility that the ANC loses power in KwaZulu-Natal next year. And the ANC in KwaZulu-Natal, to my mind, shows no signs of trying to win them back. You know, if I speak to a person on air from the ANC in KwaZulu-Natal, the dividing line, the thing you want to get them on, is do you support Zuma in court or not? Because it divides that province down the middle. And they know that. They try and dodge it a little bit. So I think that KwaZulu-Natal politics has lots of other factors that other provinces don't necessarily have. There are language issues. You do have also the other political sort of anchor in KwaZulu-Natal in the form of the king, which you don't have in other provinces. And that means that people look to different things, and so their voting identities, the elements of their identity, they have many more complex elements than you would have in Gauteng, for example, or the Western Cape. And so that makes it a lot more complex to try and predict what will happen. But I think the ANC could well lose power in KwaZulu-Natal. The EFF isn't much of a factor in KZN, so it's interesting to see who they will try and form a coalition with. But the ANC and the IFP have governed together before, but the IFP and the DA are moving much closer together. And in fact have an agreement in eThekwini that if they're contesting each other, they won't contest each other. They'll let one of them win it, which is really interesting because that can change the balance of power in the eThekwini Council. So watch that relationship between the IFP and the DA very closely. And Willem Kosini Klabisa, the leader of the IFP, will be at the DA's big moonshot launch. And I'll watch what he says very closely. Yes, sir. Well, it's quite a political question you ask me. There are a couple of very bad scenarios. So one of them would be that the outcome isn't very clear. So let me just explain what I mean. Elections can't be stolen in this country. I know politicians are going to tell you they can. They can't. And they can't because at every step of the way, from voter registration, when you go and register to vote, you'll see party agents there. When you go and vote, you will see party agents there. Representatives of the DA, the ANC, the EFF, whichever other party is there. Those agents are there when they count the votes, when they tabulate the votes, and in the final analysis. You'll notice during the counting of the votes, some of the political parties will actually come out early and say, we've won Itakwini or we've won Nelson Mandela Bay before the Electoral Commission says it. And they're saying that because they're taking the results that the IEC gives them in meetings, but the IEC re-audits them again before they make them public. That's where that information comes from. The DA actually has its own vote counting organization. They actually have a place where they're doing it, and so does the ANC. They can tell you very early on what the result will be. They won't always publish it. So it can't be, and that's because it's transparent. So you can't steal an election. However, the true test of whether Stephen Friedman, the professor who I always read, the true test of whether an election is legitimate is if the loser accepts the result. Now, some of this is easy. The Freedom Front Plus is always going to accept that it's not going to be president, okay? They're going to accept that. But the EFF may not. And so if the legitimacy of the election is not accepted, that's a very bad outcome. A second very bad outcome is where you have a very messy result and it takes a long time for parties to put together a kind of coalition. Now, in the meantime, until you have that coalition, the people who are in cabinet now stay in cabinet. So you can imagine the sort of mess that can be created during that particular time. That's a very difficult situation. And then in the longer term, you'd be talking about a political party. I suppose what you would be talking about is a government dominated by people who are, to use the phrase, extractive, which is a polite phrase for corrupt, rather than actually interested in governing. So you'll be looking at a group of people who are interested in dividing people to stay in power. You can interpret my answer how you like. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Yes. 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 Our system is much better and much more transparent. And the key moment, if you're worried about post-election violence, is when results are coming in and then the results stop. That's when the violence happens, when the results stop. So the transparency matters, and the person who told me that is now the chief electoral officer, Simon Mabordal, who I really trust. So what I'm saying is that they know exactly where the problems are, and they'll do it well. Despite everything the political parties are going to say about the Electoral Commission will do the election well. Very, very organized. I think I'm going to stop. I'm going to say two things just so that you don't just go out and head for the bar rather than the coffee. The first is that this country is incredibly transparent. So this country, almost no matter what happens, will remain free. In other words, we will not be like Zimbabwe or any of those places because freedom and the right to express yourself freely has become so entrenched. And following on from that is the demand for transparency. We all know something happened in Simonstown. We all know something happened at Pala Pala because our country is so transparent. Other countries aren't like that, but here we are. And that's a really big strength for our country that other countries don't have. And then watch the institutions. If the NPA suddenly starts charging people with corruption, and if SARS continues with its momentum now, that will change our country and change our politics for the better, regardless of who wins. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Stephen.